Geoffrey, welcome. Welcome back to Talkback.
Thank you, William. Good to be back in the studio.
Can I plunge right into this? What seems like the central issue for many, many people within unionism is the Irish Sea border. And the question is, does the deal that you've done remove the Irish Sea border?
Yes. William, if we look at what the protocol did to Northern Ireland, it created that border in the Irish Sea, which meant that goods that were moving from Great Britain to Northern Ireland were subjected to all kinds of restrictions, checks, customs declarations and so on, even if those goods were staying in Northern Ireland and not going into the EU. We supported the proposals in the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. The DUP endorsed those proposals, as did the government at the time, that those arrangements should be replaced by new arrangements and that that would involve a red lane, which would simply carry out whatever procedures were required on goods moving into the EU. And that all goods then travelling from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, staying within the UK, would go through a green lane. That then emerged in the Windsor framework. But that meant still there were checks on goods staying within the UK. And we found that unacceptable. We believe that where goods are moving within the United Kingdom and its internal market, there shouldn't be checks. There shouldn't be customs declarations, because that's what a border means. And there should not be a border within the UK internal market. These proposals, William, remove that border. There will no longer be checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, except where, as it happens across all of the UK, there's smuggling or criminality. Then, of course, the customs will deal with that criminality. But as a matter of routine, there will be no checks, no physical checks, no identity checks on goods moving from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, staying within the United Kingdom. The only checks that will be carried out are on goods moving into the EU or at risk of moving into the EU. That was what was agreed under the protocol bill. That is in these proposals. But the border between Great Britain and Northern Ireland on goods moving within the United Kingdom will be removed.
10 days ago, the DUP was plunged into the biggest crisis in its history with the resignation of its leader, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, who's facing charges on historical sex offences, which he says he will strenuously contest. As quickly as the news of Sir Geoffrey Donaldson's arrest was confirmed by the DUP, their new interim leader was also announced, the MP for East Belfast, Gavin Robinson, who is with me now in the Talkback studio to answer some of the many questions now being asked about how the DUP has been dealing with the crisis they're facing and, of course, what that may mean for the future of Stormont and the devolved institutions. Incidentally, we're live streaming right now on the BBC News website. You can text any questions you have for Gavin Robinson to 81771. Gavin, welcome. Good to have you back in the Talkback studio.
Thank you, William.
Can we step back straight away to those bombshell events of 10 days ago with the DUP announcement on Good Friday that Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was standing down as leader, having been suspended after he informed you that he'd been charged with historical sex offences. Can you walk us through the party's timeline, Gavin, of where you were when you heard the news, how this news began to emerge and how you eventually got to the point of that statement?
Yeah, well, thanks, William, and thank you for having me in. I understand entirely why we will start off by going back a few days, but I hope we'll get the opportunity to
very quickly
to walk through where we are now. I recall being in party headquarters doing meetings with councillors and aspiring councillors in the party and thinking it's Thursday afternoon, Good Friday's tomorrow, and I've got a lovely Easter break planned. That was the truth. And I was looking forward to it, looking forward to spending time with Lindsay and my son. And obviously left party headquarters, went home and discovered a number of hours later that my plans were going to change. And it became immediately obvious to me and a number of senior colleagues, whilst we didn't have all the information, that that information came to us over the coming hours. Very little sleep on Thursday night, a recognition that we needed to meet together collectively as senior members of the party. We did that first thing on Friday morning. We recognised that some of our colleagues will have gone to bed on Friday night not knowing anything, or Thursday night not knowing anything about it, and therefore our calls in the first thing on Friday morning, we would have been revealing some difficult news. But we recognised that this was quite different from issues that you may or may not have faced in the past as a party collectively, that we had to meet. We had to meet quickly. There were steps that it was appropriate for us to take, and we did that in a very humble but determined way.
When Geoffrey Donaldson sent a letter or an email, I don't know which it was, to the party officers indicating he was resigning, had there been any to and fro between the party? Had there been any discussions with him about what should happen or could happen or may happen in the circumstances before that letter?
I think obviously contact had to be made appropriately to find out what was going on, because all of us were in the dark. So there was no foretaste to this. There was no early or initial acknowledgement. We needed to find out what was going on. And I think just given the nature of it, there wasn't much to-ing and fro-ing. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that it was very clear, the direction of travel, that to continue in the capacity as leader was unsustainable, that the party would have to have decisions to make in accordance with our rules, and to do that clearly, quickly, and confidently.
And there was no debate about that?
There's no debate about it.
You didn't have to persuade him in any way to do anything?
Recognition that that
Full
was
recognition.
The direction of travel, that was going to happen. And look, you know, all of us in this life, whether you're in the same political party or if you're in a differing political parties, we have personal relationships, we have connections that go beyond politics. But in the immediacy of that time, politics, our party, our purpose and our mandate was most acute in our mind.
Next to the mesmerising story of one of the most unlikely members of the IRA, an English woman born into fabulous wealth, educated at Oxford and in the United States, with a PhD in economics from London. She could have leveraged all of that wealth and those upper class networks that were open to her and lived a life of extraordinary privilege. But Rose Dugdale, who died yesterday at the age of 83, walked away from her family, her class background and her wealth and embraced the cause of the Provisional IRA. From fundraising art thefts to bomb making, the story of her role in the 1974 Rusborough House art raid is told in a new film, Baltimore, with Imogen Poots playing Rose Dugdale. That's released next weekend. Sean O'Driscoll is with us. Sean gives a much fuller picture of her life in his book, Heiress, Rebel, Vigilante, Bomber, The Extraordinary Life of Rose Dugdale. We're also joined by Edwina Currie, the former Tory MP and minister, who was actually at Oxford, at St Anne's College, though a few years younger than Rose Dugdale, but knew her at that point. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you with us. Edwina, actually, what was she like? What was her personally like at the time when you met her?
Well, she was in and out of Oxford. Although she graduated, we had the same tutor. And according to the obituary in the Derby, in the Daily Telegraph today, they were actually lovers. I didn't know that. I mean, I'm reading this obituary and I'm thinking, Peter, you absolute cow. I mean, goodness me. And what one of the things that Peter decided to do, Peter Adich, her name was spelled P-E-T-E-R because her parents wanted a boy. She was the economics tutor at St Anne's, very distinguished woman. And one of the things that she decided to do for her own entertainment was put Rose and me together, feed us sherry in her garden one lovely summer afternoon, and get us to talk politics to each other. And Rose and I both, very quickly, we clocked each other and we both knew that we took our politics very seriously and that we were not going to produce a show for Peter's entertainment. At the time, though, Rose was, by then she was already, I think, very much involved with some of the dodgy people that she got to know much better later. She was very scruffy, which was unusual in the 1960s. She was terribly well-spoken and rather sort of laid back. I thought rather typical of quite a load of people that we used to see in Oxford in the 60s, well off, rebellious, trying to punish her parents for what she saw as unnecessary privilege, instead of, as you've just hinted, William, actually putting that privilege to good use. So you can pursue whatever political views you want, and you can do it in good ways. But she chose for the rest of her life to do it in thoroughly bad ways, which resulted in mayhem and murder.
What I'm trying to get to is the dynamics of a handler's relationship with an agent, William. And you might know that an action's about to happen, mm-hmm. or that that person's already taken part in an action where a murder was committed. Mm-hmm. But that agent's valuable in providing high-value intelligence, maybe beyond that operation to even the strategy level of an organisation like the IRA. You would feel, I'm assuming, a desire to protect the agent.
I think it's a human interaction and it's prone to the sort of human feelings. So, yep, you have a duty of care to actually protect the life of the agent, but also protect the life of people he's telling you about.
Right, and to protect them from prosecution too, because that might out them and might put them at risk.
Oh, no, you're not protecting them from prosecution. You're trying to figure out. So you talk to someone. We'll say there's a murder happened last night, and you're going to have, my boss is going to say, right, have we anybody there? Yep. What was their involvement? So you'd be asking, did you know? What was your part, etc.?
Yeah.
And the whole
What have they told you? Well, the whole part concept, of it, I shot him.
The whole concept is you'd be really, really annoyed if somebody didn't tell you beforehand what was going to happen.
You might be annoyed, but what we just heard from John Boucher here is that there was an absence, complete absence, of any kind of legal policy, any kind of policy whatsoever in the running of agents that you were involved in, for example, that this fostered a culture of mavericks who were doing stuff that was off the books. They enjoyed and, you know, playing the dark arts. They were out of control in some cases, not all of them, not all handlers, but some of them were off the books, practicing maverick dark arts. They were out of control, so that murders that could have been prevented were allowed. I'm quoting John Boucher here. Murders that could be prevented were allowed to take place, and those responsible were left free to kill again. Does that sound familiar to you?
Absolutely not.
Not?
No. No.
It just didn't happen.
Not. When I finished in the operational side, I went into training. I was training PSNI officers in source handling. And they were getting exactly the same training that was happening 20, 30 years earlier. And it is about protecting life. It's how can you protect life.
I have no doubts about myself as an actor at all.
None.
I could do anything.
Why would you?
Sorry?
Why would you?
Well, thank you.
With your career, why would you?
But as a human being, I'm terrified in case I'm not good enough, and that is my fear every day. Every day I wake up, that I'll disappoint myself or not be good to my better angels. You know that I'll disappoint myself. I suppose mostly.
And you've already told us that your understanding of yourself as an actor is umbilically connected to your sense of being a human being.
Yeah.
So they are. I can understand why you've got that kind of unsettled attitude. That's because of where you are in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, my mum's not well, and I've been, watching her disappear. She's got dementia.
And I'm so sorry.
So, it's that puts everything in perspective,
It and really does.
When your hero, the person who you're closest to, they're still there, but they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
I've never felt so kind of vulnerable in my life.
Yeah.
But that's life. It's joy and some moments of joy, and a lot of it's hard. So, yeah.
But that's a double kind of death, isn't it?
Yeah.
Physical and in terms of identity and psychological connections. I think that's the toughest. That is the toughest.
Yeah.
Give you your next choice of music.
So this song is by Sonny and Cher. It's called Laugh At Me, and it was the last song in Good Vibrations. And I remember, and like I said, ties everything together. Gary Lightbody was there. David Holmes, bless him, who fought for me to get the part. And it was my big break. And he taught me, this is why, he taught me that song because they told me I didn't have to learn it and that you wouldn't see me singing it. And they said to me, Glenn and Lisa, bless them, who were the directors, they said, you do the song now. And I'm like, whoa. So he took me up in the Ulster Hall and in 25 minutes, he taught me the words and the rhythm, the beat of it. And then I went downstairs and in front of 2,000 people, I performed it and I sang it as Terry, because he doesn't sing, Terry can't sing. He shouts everything, you know. and I remember just, there's a bit whenever the thing finishes at the end and I'm just looking out and it was just a moment I'll never forget. It was like I've arrived and I love the words. It's just like, I don't care what you think. I'm just going to be true to myself and, you know, just laugh at me because I am who I am, you know, and you can't take that away from me.
This is one of those days in history. It is one of the most famous days in history, infamous days in history, Clint. And you were there from the very beginning to the very end, at every key moment of that day, from Dealey Plaza to the hospital to the airport on Air Force One, even at the point you're standing with the First Lady when Lyndon B. Johnson is sworn in as the new president, every key part of that day.
Yes, I was. All the way through to the autopsy in Washington and transportation of the president's body to the White House after the autopsy and placing it in the East Room. The honor guard from the military being placed around it. I was a witness to all of that.
The members of the Air Force Bagpipe Band playing a funeral dirge are moving very, very slowly in measured steps toward the graveside. And at this moment, the casket is being removed from the caisson. Mrs. Kennedy standing just beside, looking on. Sadly, one can see the expression on her face through the thin black veil of her face.
And I know eventually Jackie Kennedy expressed her gratitude to you personally.
Yes, she did. She wrote a note on a card. Don't have that card right with me. I would not try and memorize it, but it was very, very kind.
What was the priority in your mind after telling family members, making sure everybody knew?
To get Kevin home. Most importantly was to get Kevin home. And Kevin was killed on a Sunday morning, early in the morning. His post-mortem took place on the Sunday afternoon. His body was released to the undertaker on the Monday. And Kevin was on the plane home on Tuesday and was in our house on the Wednesday. Now, we've taken over 1,770 people home, and there has never, ever been a repatriation as quick.
Because of the connections, the friendships, the community, well, essentially,
absolutely,
in New York. The Irish community in New York really stepped up for you and your
absolutely.
Family there.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference when you can get your son's body home so quickly for you.
Fantastic. Well, no, the thing was, I mean, obviously, we were 3 days waiting.
Yeah.
3 days in which, you know, Ethna couldn't eat, couldn't sleep or whatever. And the moment that Kevin's body was carried into the house, there was an amazing sense of calm that arrived with him. And Ethna was able to hold his hand. And in a way, he was safe. He was home.
Yeah, there's a rightness to it.
Yeah.
He is where he needed to be, back with the family.
Yes.